Alexander Hamilton, fully as much as Thomas Jefferson, believed wholeheartedly that the most natural form of government was a republic, in which everyone would have the freedom to exercise their natural rights. "As to my own political creed, I give it to you with utmost sincerity," Hamilton wrote. "I am affectionately attached to the republican theory. I desire above all things to see the equality of political rights, exclusive of all hereditary distinction, firmly established by a practical demonstration of its being consistent with the order and happiness of society." And again, "We all, with equal sincerity, profess to be anxious for the establishment of a republican government on a safe and solid basis. It is the object of the wishes of every honest man in the United States. And I presume I shall not be disbelieved when I declare that it is an object of all others, the nearest and most dear to my own heart. The means of accomplishing this great purpose become the most important study which can interest mankind." I think it's important to hear Hamilton saying that, and at such length, because from that point onwards, no two individuals among the founders could have appeared so utterly and antagonistically different as Thomas Jefferson and Alexander Hamilton. Jefferson was tall, gangly, physically awkward. Hamilton was small, lithe, swift. Thomas Jefferson was born to a Virginia plantation family, even if that plantation belonged to the distant Piedmont rather than the Tidewater. Alexander Hamilton wasn't even born on the North American continent. And his family, unlike Jefferson's, but quite a great deal like Robert Morris, gave him very little time with books. Hamilton was born on January 11, 1757, on the island of Nevis in the British West Indies. His father, James Hamilton, had some vague connections to some even more vague noble families of Scotland. His mother was Rachel Fawcett Lavion, of French Huguenot descent. Unhappily for young Alexander, their second son, Rachel was married, not to James Hamilton, but to Johann Michael Lavion, a planter on the island of St. Croix, whom she had married in 1745, and then deserted in 1750 for the embraces of James Hamilton. Rachel Lavion eventually succeeded in getting a divorce from her lawfully wedded husband, but not for the purpose of marrying James Hamilton. Hamilton set up a lackadaisical business on the island of St. Croix, and then, with the excuse of business matters on yet another island, St. Kitts, James Hamilton took ship and never reappeared. Undismayed, Rachel Lavion set up her own retail business and farmed her son Alexander out to the merchant firm of Beckman and Kruger at the tender age of 12. Far from suffering by this, Alexander Hamilton flourished. He had a ready intelligence, read whatever he could lay hands upon, and by the time he was 14, his employer, Nicholas Kruger, was leaving orders and sales in his hands. But he was also bored. "I condemn the groveling condition of a clerk or the like," he complained, "and would willingly risk my life, though not my character, to exalt my station. I mean, to prepare the way for futurity." But life in the British Sugar Islands of the West Indies was a dead-end street for someone with those ambitions. The West Indies were a cockpit of political rivalries between the great European powers, especially between the British and the French. And their value lay in the single commodity the West Indies grew better than anywhere else in the world: sugar. In an age before anyone could even dream of refrigeration, the preservation of foodstuffs could often mean the difference between a community's life and its death. Salt was the great preservative of meat, but it was not until the West Indian islands yielded the bonanza of sugar did a comparable means of preserving fruit and vegetables become available to Europeans. As early as the 1660s, the West Indian sugar crop was yielding over three times the value of tobacco cultivation in the Chesapeake Bay. By 1770, the British Sugar Islands were exporting 132,000 tons of sugar, 11 million gallons of molasses, and 41 million liters of rum. Compared to the North American colonies, per capita wealth on a sugar island like Jamaica was 1,196 pounds. In New England, per capita wealth was 32 pounds. That is, per capita wealth for free white people. The riches to be realized from the sugar trade created greater and greater concentrations of land and wealth in fewer hands. And all of it produced by the labor of black slaves in numbers and conditions that made slaveholding in the North American colonies look trivial. By the 1750s, slave imports in Jamaica reached 6,000 a year. And by 1780, 91% of the population of the entire British West Indies were black slaves. In that world, the futurity of fatherless working boys was decidedly bleak. Squeezed between the great planters at the top and the vast armies of brutalized slaves on the bottom, a fortuneless adolescent with no connections to appeal to was in a decidedly poor position. But in 1772, Hugh Knox, a Scots-Irish Presbyterian missionary, educated at the New Jersey Presbyterian College, located in Princeton, arrived in St. Croix. He took the 15-year-old Hamilton under his wing, and discovering what gifts the boy had, determined that he would be sent to Princeton for an education. Hamilton's haphazard pattern of reading did not promise much success at Princeton, nor did the admissions interview he had with Princeton's president, John Witherspoon, since Hamilton cockily proposed that Witherspoon allow him to test into whichever class his attainments would entitle him, and advance from class to class with as much rapidity as his exertions would enable him to do. Witherspoon and the Presbyterian domines who oversaw the college would have none of it. But rather than back down, Hamilton took off for New York City, where he applied to the president of the rival King's College, now Columbia University, on the same terms, and this time was admitted. And, as he had expected, Hamilton conquered the curriculum at King's College in just 2.5 years. But he never actually took his degree, because by that time, in 1775, the American Revolution had begun, and Hamilton was already well into the thick of revolutionary activities. He made his first mark as early as the summer of 1774, speaking at anti-British rallies for the Sons of Liberty, and publishing his first revolutionary tract in December. His message was simple and blunt, and straight out of the playbook of Enlightenment politics. That Americans are entitled to freedom is incontestable on every rational principle, Hamilton announced. Hierarchy and aristocracy were the fictions created by the powerful, not the arrangement sanctioned by nature. All men have one common original, Hamilton wrote. They participate in one common nature and consequently have one common right. Arbitrary and unnatural concentrations of power tempt men to tyranny. The life of the subject is often sported with, and the fruits of his daily toil are consumed in oppressive taxes that serve to gratify the ambition, avarice, and lusts of his superiors. 3 months later, Hamilton was further refining his notions of the politics of nature. He did not, however, begin with John Locke's thought experiments about the state of society, but with Sir William Blackstone's description of human nature. The deity, from the relations we stand in to himself and to each other, has constituted an eternal and immutable law which is called the law of nature. This natural law, Hamilton said, undergirded all human society. All civil government had to be constructed in harmony with that natural law. That precluded any idea that kings had some God-given sanction to impose their rule on people. To the contrary, Hamilton wrote, the origin of all civil government must be a voluntary compact between the rulers and the ruled. In the case of the King of England, therefore, he is King of America only by virtue of a compact between us and the kings of Great Britain. And if that compact had become corrupted, it was time to terminate. In fact, it was only natural. But in an unusually sophisticated insight, Hamilton went on to observe that kings are not the only ones liable to become drunk with power. It is not the supreme power being placed in one instead of many that discriminates an arbitrary from a free government. Parliament, fully as much as King George III, was culpable in the oppression of America, and perhaps even more so. And merely the fact that it was an elected legislature would do nothing to restrain Parliament from being a more intolerable and excessive species of despotism than an absolute monarchy. There was nothing inherently just or wise or virtuous or fair in legislative assemblies. Give them power, and they will become just as drunk. It is the height of folly to entrust any set of men with power which is not under every possible control. Power has to be dissipated, divided, and distributed in small enough packets to prevent its mutating into the monstrous shapes he had seen it take in the islands of his birth. He had seen enough of the way business was done there to have none of Adam Smith's confidence that commerce would automatically ensure a good and happy society. It was not that Hamilton was contemptuous of commerce. After all, he had been a merchant himself, after a fashion, for Nicholas Kruger. But he had also seen that the great sugar planters, left to themselves, had warped and twisted commerce into a human catastrophe. Commerce, Hamilton believed, has its fixed principles according to which it must be regulated. If these are understood and observed, it will be promoted by the attention of government. If unknown or violated, it will be injured. That was enough enlightenment for the moment. By the summer of 1775, Hamilton had formed his own ad hoc artillery company, which he commanded all through the disheartening campaigns of 1776. And in February of 1777, he was promoted to lieutenant colonel and a place on the staff of George Washington. Hamilton, the one-time merchant's boy, turned out to be the ideal aide-de-camp for Washington, handling Washington's correspondence, conveying orders to generals years his senior, and carrying out special assignments. There are few men to be found of his age who has a more general knowledge than he possesses, wrote Washington in praising Hamilton, and none whose soul is more firmly engaged in the cause or who exceeds him in probity and sterling virtue. Washington became a sort of surrogate father to Hamilton, just as Hamilton became a surrogate son for Washington, who had no children of his own. And he joined a company of surrogate brothers on Washington's staff that included John Lawrence, Henry Knox, and the adventuresome French volunteer, the Marquis de Lafayette. They were attached to the chief and to each other as kindred spirits, brothers alike in arms, in affection, and in accomplishments, wrote one memoirist many years later, and might be styled the preux chevalier of the American army. With the end of the Revolution, Hamilton had earned enough prominence to marry, happily and successfully, into the influential Schuyler family of New York, and began practicing law. And in 1782, he was designated by the New York legislature as a member of New York's delegation in the Confederation Congress. He had never ceased reading, even during the Revolution, when he scratched out notes on unused pages of the paybook for his old artillery company. Nor had he ceased thinking in terms that moved in very different directions from the man who would become his arch rival, Thomas Jefferson. Americans now had themselves a republic. But what was a republic? In the shortest sense, a republic was any form of government in which sovereignty resided in the people, not in a separate ruling class or a king, and where the people were citizens and not merely subjects. But having said that much, republics then varied along a very wide spectrum. They could be oligarchies, where practical power remained in the hands of a few of the citizens, like the city-states of Renaissance Italy. Or they could be, at the other end of the spectrum, out-and-out democracies, where the people, the demos, were not only the source of sovereignty, but actively participated in government through popular assemblies. Unhappily, there had been only a few examples of successful republics in human history, Rome and Athens being the most widely admired. And those classical republics offered only a handful of useful rules for guidance. So what was a republic according to those rules handed down from the classical past? Well, first among those rules was that a republic must be harmonious. It cannot be divided in purpose. It must be guided by a common vision of the public good. The public good is or ought to be the only object of pursuit to every servant of the republic, wrote one Boston pamphleteer. Because, as yet another Boston pamphlet writer explained, the strength and glory of such a republic depend on the virtue of the people, which is real dignity. That of monarchy is supported by the glare of earthly grandeur, by the pageantry of heroism, and the weapons of death, which is royal dignity. This intoxicates the senses, but the other touches the heart. Second rule, a republic must be homogeneous. It must be composed of citizens who are ethnically, economically, and socially more or less equal with each other in wealth and status. America was home to no great lords or nobles. Even the wealthiest of American landowners was comparatively minor when set against the grandees of the British House of Lords. America's wealthiest planters, like Charles Carroll of Carrollton, Maryland, might enjoy an income of £1,800 per annum. But this was warm spit compared to the Earl of Derby's £40,000 per annum. Moreover, the new state constitutions had been written with a view to preventing big concentrations of property in the future by outlawing the British laws of entail, which required that estates descend intact to their heirs, and replacing them with laws requiring partible inheritance. It was the great advantage of America, argued the Vermonter Jonathan Atwood, that property in this country is pretty equally distributed among the people, and the principles of a just and equal distribution are recognized and established by the laws which regulate the descent of estates. And if ever such unequal concentrations of power did appear, Benjamin Trumbull of New Haven believed that it will be highly politic not to suffer a few persons to amass all the riches and wealth of a country. Third rule for a republic, by the classical standards. A republic must be small, if only because harmony and homogeneity break down whenever the boundaries of a republic are drawn to include too many different kinds of people, or so much territory that people cannot keep vigil over their fellow citizens. Montesquieu had warned that it is natural to a republic to have only a small territory. Otherwise, it cannot long subsist, because the interest of the public is easier perceived, better understood, and more within the reach of every citizen on a small scale. Fourth rule, every citizen of a republic must be independent and self-sufficient enough to be able to occupy a public office. Benjamin Franklin wished a New York correspondent of his all the satisfaction that ease and retirement from public business can possibly give you, but he warned him not to slight the obligation of public office. Let not your love of philosophical amusements have more than its due weight with you. Had Newton, been pilot but of a single common ship, the finest of his discoveries would scarce have excused or atoned for his abandoning the helm 1 hour in time of danger. How much less if she had carried the fate of the Commonwealth? These rules were certainly the rules which guided Thomas Jefferson's notion of a republic. Never was a finer canvas presented to work on than our countrymen, he informed John Adams. All of them engaged in agriculture or the pursuits of honest industry, independent in their circumstances, enlightened as to their rights, and firm in their habits of order and obedience to the laws. We have seen no instance of this since the days of the Roman Republic. If ever the morals of a people could be made the basis of their own government, it is our case. But Hamilton had learned from two very different sources that these classical rules, and Jefferson's satisfaction with them, might not be quite so admirable as they sounded. One of these sources was his reading of David Hume. Hamilton regarded the celebrated Scot, whose Essays and Treatises of 1758 and History of England from the Invasion of Julius Caesar to the Revolution in 1688 were enormously popular among Americans, as very ingenious and sensible and the least fallible guide of human opinion. And what Hamilton learned from Hume was that governments, including Republican governments, cannot be invented out of thin air or pressed into an Iron Maiden of theory. Hume had no particular love for monarchy, but he did not believe that the British monarchy had always been bad in all cases, or that it merited being thrown out with the bathwater. I am apt, Hume cautioned, to entertain a suspicion that the world is still too young to fix many general truths in politics, which will remain true to the latest posterity. We have not as yet had experience of 3,000 years. So that not only the art of reasoning is still imperfect in this science, as in all others, but we even want sufficient materials upon which we can reason. Politics should rest on experience, not theory, on practical realities, not ideology. Considerations like that rendered Hamilton suspicious of reliance on the rule of virtue, much less of reliance on economies limited to agriculture, or of expectations that keeping republics small would keep them pure. The West Indies, on that logic, should have been showcases for republicanism. Instead, they were ruled by raw, grasping self-interest, pursued by agriculturalists who were anything but virtuous, yet who had managed to establish an absolute homogeneity and done it all on islands like Barbados, which had only about 100,000 acres of arable land, but which were nevertheless transformed into hell holes of misery and exploitation rather than independence. In questions which affect the existence and collective happiness of these states, Hamilton wrote in 1782, all nice and abstract distinctions should give way to plainer interests and to more obvious and simple rules of conduct. Hamilton also felt, with personal keenness, that Jeffersonian rules about homogeneity and harmony were most likely to operate to the exclusion not of the corrupt, but of honest outsiders like himself, who had no land, no inheritance, nothing but talent and ambition to offer the new republic. There is a bigotry in politics as well as in religions, Hamilton wrote, equally pernicious in both. And the moment one begins arguing that only landowners can be virtuous, bigotry sprouts. If, as the great British essayist, wit, and dictionary maker Samuel Johnson said, there are few ways in which a man can be more innocently employed than in getting money, then why restrict virtue only to the hearts of farmers? The other source which fed Hamilton's skepticism about elegant but rigid concepts of republicanism was the behavior of the Confederation Congress. Even during the Revolution, Hamilton had been sickened by the folly, caprice, and want of foresight which characterized the general tenor of their actions. What had been folly in war turned out to be folly in peace, as the states asserted their veto over the impost proposal, all the while spewing out emissions of unsecured paper money and claiming sovereignty over their own portions of the United States war debt. "Our prospects are not flattering," Hamilton sighed to John Jay in 1783. "Every day proves the inefficacy of the present Confederation. Yet, we are receding instead of advancing in a disposition to amend its effects." The same month, Hamilton drafted proposals to amend the Articles of Confederation so as to grant the United States in Congress assembled the power of general taxation, only to set the proposal aside for want of support. Even worse, the New York legislature was fulfilling every one of his anxieties about despotism being as much a threat from the many as from the one, when the legislature set about confiscating the property of one-time loyalists. Hamilton defended them in court on the grounds that the confiscation was a violation of the protective provisions for loyalists in the Treaty of Paris. "A number of attempts have been made," he warned Robert Livingston in the spring of 1785, "to subvert and destroy the rights of private property." And the specter of Shays Rebellion the following year did nothing to relieve Hamilton's anxieties. But the cherry on top was the New York legislature's move, early in 1786, to begin buying up the Confederation Congress's bonds and notes with $500,000 of paper money. Now, ostensibly, this was done as an act of charity towards New Yorkers who had been waiting since the Revolution for Congress to redeem the IOUs and securities it had issued for goods and supplies. What it really did was to make Congress a creditor of the state of New York, so that the state legislature had a financial stick to beat Congress with. Worse still, in another gesture of phony charity, the New York legislature offered to allow the Confederation Congress to collect the long-desired impost on New York commerce, but only if Congress agreed to dedicate the revenue from the impost to servicing its debt, which of course meant that the impost would end up in the pockets of the New York legislature. From his seat in the state legislature, Hamilton protested, "The United States are entrusted with the management of the general concerns and interests of the community. They have the power of war and peace. They have the power of treaty. Let us not endeavor still more to weaken and degrade the federal government by heaping fresh marks of contempt on its authority." It did no good. But if Hamilton could not persuade the Confederation Congress or the New York legislature to come to their senses, he did have one last court of appeal, and that was George Washington.